This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture with me, Dashran Johan. And today we are going to be speaking to a screenwriter, playwriting teacher, and now author who recently published his first book titled Palooka, 12 Rounds to Fatherhood. The book details the author's personal struggle with infertility and the in vitro fertilization journey he goes on with his wife. So zooming in all the way from Singapore is the author of Palooka, 12 Rounds to Fatherhood, James Tu. Hey man, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. So I guess first things first, how does it feel to have published a book? The book hit the shelves a couple of weeks ago, I believe. So what has the whole experience been like?
The experience of it has been, honestly, it was quite a daunting prospect, and it didn't start out as a book. It started out just, we were spending a lot of time in hospital rooms going through the procedure. So it started with being me sitting there with time to kill and just kind of writing about it, because that's what I do. And then it kind of stowed away somewhere. And then I met a publisher, and she read the manuscript and really kind of took the reins and championed it from start to finish. And so I was really just a passenger, kind of holding on as she made everything happen. It's been very cool. I'm not really a novelist, so it is cool to add another arrow to the bow, I guess. It's been cool. Very cool.
Yeah. So, what has the reception been like so far? I think it's been 2 weeks now, right, since the book came out?
Yeah, the book, we opened it up to friends and family, and it went on sale about a week ago, I think. Yeah, it's been great. The response is, to be honest, the most popular response that I get is that it's very brave, which is cool, but I don't know if it's necessarily earned, because I don't really, to me, being brave is when you do something that you're scared to do. I was never really scared to tell people about my business. it is what it is. It was mostly like, everyone is going to know that we had problems. Well, everyone that knows me is going to know that we had problems. And I don't want people to think it might be my wife's problem. So, coming out and owning it was the right thing to do, I think. So I never really thought it was particularly brave to talk about it. I think the important thing to me is that I think there is some literature on the subject of infertility and male infertility, but mm-hmm. not, so far as I know, no literature that approaches the subject with the kind of levity that I think is needed to really, to get through an experience that sucks as much as that. Right. Just unyielding positivity doesn't always do it, I think. Sometimes you have to be able to kind of look at your situation and laugh, and there's so many ways that it can screw up, and so I think at times you need to be able to just think this is absurd and be able to have a chuckle at the situation as horrible as it is. And so the response to that's been cool. So I'm very pleased that people think that there are jokes to be made about the subject, because I was a little bit worried that people would be like, no, this is a very taboo subject, and you have to treat it with the respect that it deserves. Fortunately, the sense of humor has been received quite well.
All right. So I'm going to talk to you about what you mentioned, whether people calling you brave and also the sense of humor in just a bit, right? But let's talk about the title first. So your title is Palooka, 12 Rounds to Fatherhood. And for those who aren't familiar, this is a boxing reference. And Palooka, I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is a term used to describe average prize fighters. And in fact, so here's a funny thing, right? When you sent me the manuscript, I think 5-6 months ago, I skipped the title, and because I was so excited, I went straight to the prologue. And it starts, so I had no idea what the book was about. And it starts with you describing how important 3 minutes can be to a boxer in the ring. And you follow that with a story on a match between Kit Gavilan and Johnny Bratton before you finally seamlessly tie everything together with the infertility issues that you're going through, which I thought was a wonderful curveball. Why did you decide to go with this approach? Because there are boxing references throughout the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, in pretty early on in the experience, one of the questions that always kept popping up from, I mean, not in regards to book, but just the experience was, you know, how much is too much in terms of disappointment? You know, at what point do you start thinking about giving up or not doing it? I met quite a few people that have done several rounds of IVF and failed and decided the psychological hardship was too much and they didn't want to put themselves through it anymore. And so they gave up or they went to adopt or whatever that may be. And for me, at least, that was never an option. I think it's because of, you know, my family's background is all in boxing. My dad was a fighter and my brother's a professional fighter right now. We own boxing gyms. And so all of our heroes are, you know, the way that my dad was raised us was that quitting is unacceptable. Mm. You know, where that verges onto toxic masculinity, I'm not sure, but that was definitely how we were raised. And so it seemed, I think, a pretty apt metaphor for the experience. And, you know, in trying to talk about the whole experience and the places that you go mentally, made things easier to equate them to the trials and tribulations that you face in a ring, because, you know, in that prologue, one of the things I talk about is how you can do so many things in 3 minutes of a boxing round, but the one thing you can't do is quit. That's the one thing that's unacceptable. You know, you can be Mike Tyson and bite someone's ear off, or you can hit someone low, or you can cheat, but you cannot quit. And right. So for the experience of going through IVF, when quitting seemed to be on everybody's mind around us, as you know, it took the psychological toll and the financial toll. For us in the fight, as you will, quitting was not an option. So it seemed like the two, as different as they may seem, they actually shared a lot of similarities. So it made sense, I think.
Right. And I also love that, yes, you include a lot of boxing references. It's in fact, you know, each chapter of the novel is titled after boxing matches that were personal to you. But it's not about boxers necessarily, but rather humans who are going through struggles in the ring and how you tie all of that into the struggles that you are going through. So now let's go back to what you were talking about earlier, you know, this whole idea of, you know, toxic masculinity, which I brought up even in the introduction. And I said that we live in a world where men are usually afraid to talk about their infertility. And they are always worried about what society and family members would say. And sometimes people's automatic perception is, oh, it's probably the wife's fault. So how did you find the courage to write about this? You said it's not bravery, but did it just come to you very easily?
There's the impression possibly that because I wrote the book that I'm extremely woke or I'm some kind of Renaissance man. That's not the case. It just so happens that this particular issue, having experienced it, I feel quite strongly about, and so I think I'm very happy to talk about it. In terms of finding the confidence, I don't know, man. I just never felt that it was something to be ashamed of. I've never had a negative experience from telling another guy that I had issues with infertility. And mm-hmm. you know, one of my closest friends lost a testicle to cancer a few mm-hmm. years ago, and people mercilessly just call him one or Lance Armstrong. It's not a particularly nurturing group of friends, but maybe it's because everybody knew how much I wanted to be a father and how much of a bummer it was for me. But I can't say I've ever had a negative experience, but I have had many positive experiences from people who I didn't know particularly well come up to talk to me about the issue that they are having, that they've been unable to talk to their actual friends about. And it's actually been surprisingly enriching. You know, if I can be emboldened enough to talk about it and demonstrate that to, you know, one person that it's okay to talk about, then I think there's real significant value in that.
Definitely, because although, you know, you say that you were not brave, you know, it didn't come from a place of courage or anything when it comes to writing the book. I think this book is going to help a lot of people who aren't courageous to talk about it, who do feel like there's a taboo, you know, or if society or their family members are going to look at them a certain way because of this. I think this could potentially help them open their minds and, you know, feel that they are not alone.
That's also why the boxing thing was important, because it would send less of a message, I think, if the book was written by a more modern or more open-mindedly raised guy. But the way I was brought up by my dad, who was an extremely hard, old school kind of strong silent type.
Right. Let's talk about your dad for a second, because the story mostly revolves around you and your wife, right? But throughout the book, your father's presence is felt. And, you know, either through conversations you imagine you'd be having with him or conversations you actually had with him. Can you tell us a little bit about your relationship with your father and why it was so important to you to include him in your story?
I mean, my dad, he had to be part of the book because, I mean, the way that I look at the book is, I mean, I think about, you know, James Baldwin said that writing is really, you know, how relentlessly will you force from this experience the last drop of blood? And so that's when I thought about writing this book, it had to be this total account of fatherhood. And so that not only means my experience of being a father or wanting to be a father, but also the experience of being fathered, right? And so my dad was a huge part of that. I would say that my relationship with my dad was not particularly great.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because we're too similar in retrospect, I'm not sure. I didn't, you know, realize that at the time. But we didn't really talk much, and he's you know, one of those stereotypical tough guys, and he certainly kind of admit weakness, never mind talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But our relationship after, because like I would say that the villain in the book is, well, I mean, it's my infertility, but it's largely this toxic impression of fatherhood, and my quest to be able to get the opportunity to do it better. Mm-hmm. So he features fairly extensively and not in the best way. And so before the book was published, obviously I wanted him to read it to, you know, whatever our relationship was, you make sure that he was okay with the many anecdotes of him. Yeah.
So what does your father think about the book?
My dad, I think the book actually, you know, even if the book sells zero copies, I'll be able to say the book was an extremely positive experience for me because it made my relationship with my dad much better. And when he read it, I think the text that because I sent it to him and said, look, just tell me if there's anything you don't want me to talk about or you want me to take out. And then the message that he gave me back was, you know, it was perfect and he wouldn't want to change anything. I think he would have said that whether he read it or not. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't read that and I was like, oh my God, it's a great book. It's crazy because I always try to tell my wife, like, since he read the book and he, I guess, saw what I was thinking about our relationship this whole time, which I never talked to him about or articulated at all because we weren't, you know, supposed to talk about our feelings or whatnot. Since reading that book, he has changed completely. And so he's this really suddenly sweet and loving guy. And it's crazy because my wife has never seen the original dad, her parents, my in-laws. So it's like we have these group chats and every time we finish talking, he'll be like, love you. And he'll send like emojis and they'll be like, oh my God, your dad's so sweet. And I'll be like, no, man, you don't know. But yeah, now it's great. He's, you know, extremely supportive of the book. I think he ordered in bulk, actually. I think he bought like 12 copies or something for his friends and whatever. So yeah, it's saved my relationship with my dad.
Well, that's fantastic to hear. So I would say that, you know, this whole experience has been rather cathartic. Would you call it that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, maybe I would feel differently if we hadn't been able to have a kid. Spoiler alert. But now looking back, it's awesome. The experience sucked, but you can look at it now as one of those challenges that we had to overcome as a couple. It made us stronger. You know, made my relationship with my dad stronger. everything has worked out, that the book's been great.
Okay. All right. We do need to take a quick break, though. But when we come back, James and I are going to continue talking about his IVF journey as well as his unique writing style. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back once again to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Dashun Yohan, and zooming in from Singapore is James Tu, the author of Palooka, 12 Rounds to Fatherhood, which is what we're talking about right now. So before the break, we talked about how the book confronts ideas of toxic masculinity and how you found the courage to write this book. So James, now I have to ask, can you take us back to the day you first found out about your infertility? What went through your mind at the time?
What went through my mind at the time was guilt, extreme guilt. You know, my wife works so hard and I was going to drop this on her and just make her life so difficult now because of me. And so at the time, like, I didn't know what caused it. And I assumed it was, I don't know, you know, the fighting that I'd done when I was younger, or the alcohol I was drinking or whatever that was. And so as far as I knew, we couldn't have kids and it was all my fault. And it was probably something that I'd done. And so, it was an incredible sense of guilt that I felt.
You think this sense of guilt that you felt has something to do with the idea, you know, that that men are not supposed to experience this, for example. Not that they are not, you know, it happens to, you know, it can happen to anyone, but more of this perception or the society's idea that, you know, guys have to be fertile and then that's what makes you a real man. Do you think that has anything to do with the guilt that you were feeling?
Yeah, definitely. Doubly so, I guess, because I'd wanted to have kids for years and she'd wanted to have some time as a married couple and enjoy our lives first, but I've just been pressuring her nonstop, like an and so I've been kind of pressuring her the whole time, and then, you know, when it finally came to time to do the thing, all the arguments we'd had and all the debates that we'd had was pointless because I couldn't even do the deed. And so as a guy, I certainly felt like I wasn't living up to all my responsibilities. You know, she's a very traditional woman, and I'm sure she imagined a nice family with two kids as I did, and she had held up her part of the bargain and I wasn't. So yeah, very disappointing.
But how did you sort of tell yourself okay? Because you know now you're at a state of, for example, at that time you were disappointed. How did you, you know, sort of reconcile that with yourself and say, okay, now it's time to take the next step? What were the following discussions like with your wife? How did you eventually decide that IVF was the way to go?
I mean, I don't like to dwell on unfortunate circumstances, and fortunately, my wife's the same. So I think I called her and went straight to her office to meet her downstairs and explain the situation to her. And the situation is, as I'd been praised of, was that we could do IVF or we could do a slightly less costly but also less the lower chance of success procedure, which is the ICSI. But me, I guess, you know, looking back, I didn't feel that we had the time because I really wanted to be a young dad. You know, my experience with my dad was not great, but the few times that it was great was when we played sport together. And so I wanted to have kids when I was young enough to do that with them. And so IVF was the highest chance of success. So it was, you know, it was a no-brainer that we would do that and do that as soon as possible.
So for a lot of people who have not experienced this, we know that IVF isn't easy. But I don't think a lot of us actually realize how insanely complicated and tiring the whole process can be. So you don't have to reveal everything that you talked about in the book. But what would you say are some of the biggest lessons about the IVF journey that you have learned?
I mean, you say that you don't think that anyone expects it to be easy. I thought it was going to be easy, dude. I thought they just go in there, get the eggs, and then we just do it. But there are, I don't think maybe for like the first 6 months, I don't think we had a single consultation where I wasn't surprised. Like, and you know, there's a range of technicality. There's stuff that was turned out to be obvious to many people. Like, I didn't even know that women have different numbers of eggs. And I didn't even know that you don't make more eggs as you get older. You're born with you know, this set amount of eggs, and that's the amount of eggs that you have for life. I didn't know that. You know, I didn't know that. And so then when it came time to extract my wife's eggs, it turned out that she was on the low scale. And so you know, the first time that we did IVF, we got one egg, which was not even really enough to do the procedure, which was crazy. And then once you get the eggs, there are different egg qualities and clarities, and then, you know, you don't know that every egg is going to successfully fertilize. And then when they do fertilize, you can you need to freeze them to store them, but then they might die on defrosting. There's just a million ways that it can all go wrong. And I had no idea of any of this. When the prospect of IVF was raised, I thought, okay, this is going to be, it's going to be a struggle for her because of all the drugs she's going to have to take. But ultimately, it's a foolproof thing. It happens. I didn't know that you can go 6, 7, 8, 9 rounds and it never happened for you. I didn't even know that. That was the first thought that I had where I thought, okay, this is a worthwhile book, because there are just so many things I didn't know going in. And even like a pamphlet would have been helpful, to be honest.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I when I was reading the book, I did not expect it to be this complex. I learned so much from it. It was quite mind-blowing, to be honest. But one of the most heartbreaking parts of the novel is when your wife suffered from a miscarriage after your first round of IVF. And this part honestly broke me. I'm not usually necessarily like a guy that demands a happy ending. You know, I love movies that are depressing all the way. But when I read that, I just thought to myself, I was like, James, this story better have a happy ending. That's how broken I was at that point. What went through your mind when you heard about the miscarriage?
It's the crazy thing. Well, actually, there were two crazy things. The first crazy thing was how, because I mentioned that I'd been the one in the relationship, the one with the kid, the whole time. And so at the beginning, there was an amount of trepidation because I wanted to have the kid and I wanted it to work out for me. But after she got pregnant, things started to change because I could see that she, you know, each day that went past, each hour that went past, I could see that she was, you know, falling more and more in love with the idea of being a mom. You know, there was a baby inside of her. And so it changed, my feeling changed from, you know, being scared that it wouldn't work out for me to being scared that it wouldn't work out for her. Mm-hmm. And so when we found out that she had a miscarriage, I didn't even really feel bad for myself at the time. I felt bad for her because, you know, now she had gotten used to the idea that she was going to be a mom. So that was the first thing. So in terms of like my own sadness, I didn't really have time for that. And that's because of the crazy thing, which was, you know, the very next day after finding out, we got called to the doctor's office and then we found out that, it was much worse than just a miscarriage. Alicia was going to need life-saving surgery. So there was really not much time to contemplate the miscarriage, really. It was, you know, whisked off straight away that, you know, a few hours later into major surgery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thought that we'd lost the kid was dwarfed by the thought that she might die. Yeah, it maybe would have been worse if things had been fine after that. But there really was no time to really dwell on it.
So after going through all of that, you know, of course, you know, what we are talking about here is sort of like a truncated version of, you know, what you can actually read in the book. But you know, after going through all of that, all the struggles, what did it feel like to eventually find out that your second IVF was successful, then and you're going to have a kid? It's happening, no questions.
No, but that's not true. There were questions. Okay. There were questions for the rest of the 9 months. It's like, it's crazy. I was watching this play and it was about a woman who was infertile or whatever, but and then she, at the end of the play she gets pregnant, she has a pregnancy test, and it's, she has this triumphant moment where she holds it up on the corner, she stood at the corner of the stage, she's holding up like this freaking Lion King, and it's like that doesn't mean anything, man. Now you've got to get through you know, the first test to make sure that it's growing properly, you have to track these integers to make sure that it's okay, and then once it, you know, hits the 6 week mark, then you've got to do a test for Down syndrome, and you go to test for all these things, and it's just, there's no, I mean, maybe for a normal couple, because you feel like, well, I mean, first of all, you don't think about the idea of anything going wrong, but then if something does go wrong, that's cool, like you can just make another one. For us, you know, it's a lot more difficult. So now all I can say about that was, like, if I was glad, but there was a calculator that I found on some website, which was like the percentage chance of miscarriage and how, like, it changes every day. Mm. And I checked that every day, like literally for 9 months, every day. It was the first thing I did in the morning, was like, okay, what's the percentage chance today? Oh, we went down a percentage point. It's only 60% today. And yeah, it was just, dude, even when the baby was delivered, it was still, it's still on eggshells. And then I think the next day the pediatrician came by and said that she had jaundice. It was just never ending. And then I was worried about the jaundice that she had for like a couple of months after that. And I didn't want to allow myself to be excited, because, you know, the double heartbreak in such a short period of time.
You don't want to get your hopes up. It
would have been rough.
But now you do have a kid. How old is your kid, and how are things going?
She's 8 months, and she is the son that I always wanted. So rough and brave, and she's just so physical, not gentle. Yeah, I don't know. She's awesome.
I mean, that's absolutely wonderful to hear. Okay, so now we're going to veer a little bit away from your personal experiences. I'm going to steal a quote from, you know, the late, great Roger Ebert, who said that when it comes to film, it's not just what it's about, but how it's about it. And I think the same thing applies to books as well, you know, and all forms of art, actually. So what I love about your book is that I don't just love your story, but how you tell your story. I think that's very important, because it's heartwarming. And sometimes, you know, there are parts, as I mentioned earlier, that just broke me. But it's also incredibly funny from start to finish. And it also feels very sincere. So tell us a bit about your approach to writing this book in terms of style.
Well, thank you for saying those generous things. I mean, you know, I wrote for so long as a journalist, and I think that really helped to craft or cultivate whatever voice I may think that I have. And so the voice comes fairly natural, because I just wrote it as myself. I think in terms of how did I write about things, Virginia Woolf had this quote. She said that a writer can't write about the soul, because when you look at it, it disappears. It's not something you can see. But if you write about, you know, the ceiling fan, or you write about the animals in the zoo, then your soul will come through. And so I think, you know, taking that approach, if I, like, for example, there were periods where I felt extreme bitterness and jealousy of other parents. And so if I'd have, you know, dedicated 5,000 words to my own bitterness, I don't know how interesting that would have been. But instead, I can write about and rank my friends who don't deserve to have children. And, you know, that my bitterness comes through that, I'm sure. But it's a lot more fun way to write about things, I guess, than just, you know, describing how I feel.
Right.
So I try to do that as much as possible.
You make a lot of jokes, not just about other people, but also about yourself. Like, you constantly poke fun of yourself throughout the novel. Was that a way for you to deal with some of the more difficult things that were going through, you know, in your life? Was that a way of coping?
Maybe, but I think more likely it's probably just a result of my dad's masculine parenting. And, you know, we have this running thing with my wife where I've never looked at the piece of clothing before I bought it, like on me.
Okay.
Because I have this interior monologue of my dad be, oh, whoa, you think you look handsome, is it? Whoa, everyone's, whoa, who wants to see what you look like? And like stuff like that always plays in my head. Like, or, you know, I do a lot of cooking at home, and, you know, if I tell my friends that I made pizza or something, but they'll be like, dude, send a picture. And I'll be like, dude, I'll just imagine my dad in my head saying, oh, you think, what, your pizza's great, is if you want to see your pizza. So like that's just, I don't know, that the self-deprecating voice is just is always in my head, and I think it's my dad, to be honest. But it does make getting through stuff easier.
Yeah, and it definitely made the book a lot more fun to read as well. So here's another thing, right? You told me sometime back that almost everything that's mentioned in the book is real. But the thing is, when you are reading it, it's so hilarious. Like, what? Your doctor, for example, who's featured quite prominently in the book, who's clearly, you know, desensitized to all this. For him, it's just another patient, you know. And the way he talks to you, for example, had me cracking up. So when you poke fun at your friends and you know, when you're poking fun at the things that are going on around you, how did you take these little everyday occurrences and inject humor and personality? First of all, did you just sort of sit at home and remember, okay, so this is what the doctor did, now let's add a comedic touch to it? What was your process like?
I think the humor comes from a clash of cultures. I also tried to actively make light of the situation because I felt like it was, you know, a very heavy experience that we were going through. And, you know, as we talked about, I felt an amount of guilt for that. And so I thought that with my, you know, almost total lack of shame, something that I could do for my wife was to try to make the experience at least a little bit fun. So I was guilty of, you know, asking a lot of stupid questions of the doctor that, you know, I could have not. Or, I was actively looking for humor through the entire experience, just because I thought, you know, there's so little that I was actually responsible for. There's so much of the load is undertaken by the woman. And, you know, bringing some levity to my wife's experience was, you know, it felt like the least that I could do to try to help her, because I wasn't doing much else.
Okay, before I let you go, I just want to say this book is honestly incredibly inspiring, right? And I don't think it will only be inspiring to future parents or men who are struggling with their own infertility problems. I think anyone who's going through a tough time would feel more optimistic about their own personal journey, whatever struggles they are going through after reading it. What do you hope people take away from this memoir?
Yeah, that's exactly it. The book is probably going to be marketed or looked at as two things. One, either it's about boxing or it's about infertility. And our proofreader, or one of the proofreaders who did the last run, one of the, I think I say in the prologue that, you know, we're talking about things that you can't do in 3 minutes. And I talk about Mike Tyson biting a guy, but he's now, you know, one of the most beloved and famous celebrities in the world. Mm. And she left a note for me saying that I need to edit that because that's not true. She doesn't even know who Mike Tyson is. And I was like, why is this person proofreading my book? And but then you know, upon further reflection, it made me think, but she also loved the book.
Yeah.
And so that made me feel really great because, you know, I, as you said, I do indulge a little bit in the boxing anecdotes, and it didn't affect her ability to appreciate the mm-hmm. book. And certainly, like, as you said, my wife was trying to figure out what she was going to say about it on her Facebook thing when she was sharing it with her friends. And she talked about how it was about, if you're going through infertility or whatever, then, you know, this is important. But I don't look at the book as that at all. I look at the book as just overcoming struggle in general, whatever that might be. And hopefully it helps people who are shy or nervous to talk about their infertility. But beyond that, the hope is that, you know, somebody that is going through some heavy experience that there's nothing to do with infertility, but is able to extrapolate some positive message from the book would be really cool. And I hope it's able to do that for at least somebody.
I hope the same. Where can people buy this book?
So you could have bought the book at bookstores everywhere before Corona. Now, I believe it's Kinokuniya only. As far as physical bookstores for the time mm-hmm. being, but you can buy the book at james2.com.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today, James.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I've been speaking to James Tu, the author of Palooka, 12 Rounds to Fatherhood. If you missed any part of this conversation or any previous Live and Learn episodes, you can check out our podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or on Spotify. I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.